Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It's very nice to have you with us on this Thursday morning, 14 minutes past 9 o'clock. Very nice to have you, and thank you very much for being here. Let me introduce everyone to you. By the way, you can get in on the fun by writing to us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let me introduce the group to you, Wall Street investment banker, second day in a row. Make it a true daily double.
Joe, it's Groundhog.
Mark Whitman is there, yes.
Thanks, it's Groundhog Day. They told me to get it right today.
Yeah. Well, Punxsutawney Phil, as you just heard in the news, saw his shadow. He whispered into the Grand Poobah's ear. And in what Republicans call science. And 6 more weeks of winter.
No.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yep. Yep.
Is it ever really a question in upstate New York?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. I don't know that, but I do also find it interesting that the same creature that eats my shed is responsible for our weather forecast.
Mm-hmm.
Because as of now, the groundhog would not be able to get under the shed because there's so much snow.
Mm.
So maybe 6 more weeks, and I would think you would want to, you know, get going under there, but we'll see. Mark, thank you very much for being here. Thank you for bringing up Groundhog Day. Sarah Rogerson joins us, Albany Law School professor of law, director of the Justice Center, and director of Immigration Law Clinic. Good morning, Sarah Rogerson.
Good morning.
So nice to have you here. Linda Ellerbe is with us. She is a Peabody and Emmy Award-winning journalist. She is our dear friend, and she's in Mexico. Hello, Linda.
Hey, right.
Good morning.
Really nice to have you back, as always. Alan Chartok is here last, certainly not least.
We left
Alan here to the end because I wanted to get his words in on our lockbox. Our lockbox is open, and it is open for business, and we need you. We would love for you to take part. We are more than halfway through the drive already. And we officially start on February 13th, but why put off till the 13th what you can do today, right?
I couldn't agree with you more, and it's extraordinary how generous people can be and are being. So if you're out there right now and you are a WAMC-er, just do what you need to do, and we're looking forward to hearing from you. You know, as we always say, how'd you do? How'd you do? How's your mother? How's your brother? How are you?
Okay. And somehow that means give us money. WAMC.org, and it's $540,000 in the lockbox. So that's good. 540? We'll take that.
It's not good enough.
Okay.
You know, the fact is, we could do, why are we fooling around? We could do it right now, right? Everybody walks to a telephone and dials 1-800-323-9262.
Or not that.
Why not? That's not the right number, right?
Well, no, we would go, best to go online, I think.
Okay, at WAMC.org.
There you go. If you call, we can handle it. We don't have anybody standing by.
You're so
all
right. Operators are not standing by at Lewis Aluminum.
No, they're working. But yeah. we'll have them when we, you know, start in full, and we'll have a few along the way, but, you know.
We can handle what you throw at us.
Absolutely. Always can, always will be able to. Mm-hmm. WAMC.org, WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you. All right. Let's get started. I will admit, I will just tell you straight out of the gate here, I had difficulty finding, like, the lead story, the story that I really wanted to start with this morning. I thought that was of great importance, that would get everybody all riled up and talk about what's going on. So the best I can do And I know we've talked a lot about the debt ceiling and the debt limit, but I would like to talk about the relationship between the new House Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, and the President of the United States. They met yesterday to talk about how to raise the federal debt ceiling. And McCarthy came out of the meeting and said he saw potential common ground after meeting privately with Biden for more than an hour Wednesday to kick off talks aimed at averting a potentially catastrophic default on the national debt. Speaking to reporters outside the White House after the meeting, McCarthy said he and the president agreed to address the debt limit in a responsible way and that they are not discussing cutting Social Security or Medicare as some Republican lawmakers have pushed. Alan, what do you make of that?
Well, if you know, you gotta really believe that the American people are wise to this sort of cat and mouse game that goes on every time. We are in a place where we really do have to be responsible with the people's money and with the people's ideas. And I think that this is a very good moment for us to look at that. Period.
Mark.
I have a few thoughts. If you look at this dance between the Republicans and the Democrats, it reminds me a lot of when you see in a municipality a very essential union negotiating with government, say the police or even the sanitation workers, threatening to strike. The people at the bargaining table are sort of hostage to groups that aren't at the table, and there's a certain amount of performance heat and light that has to emanate from the negotiating table before either side is satisfied that their representative went to the mat on their behalf. And certainly there is some of that going on here. A couple of other observations. It's interesting, Mitch McConnell is right when he says that whatever gets worked out has to be palatable to the House and to the president. And it should then work in the Senate. But he said an interesting phrase when he said, well, we are behind Kevin McCarthy, which I think sums up a lot of Mitch McConnell's political career, sort of standing behind others at the forefront of controversies. Mitch has proven himself perfectly happy to stand behind somebody else and blame them for a kerfuffle like this. The other third observation I have is, if you recall back during the Obama administration, this happened twice. And in at least one case, Joe Biden himself was actually the point negotiator for the debt ceiling limit. It's interesting to take some comfort from the fact that he's seen this dance before. I'm also curious to see if Biden asks his vice president to take a similar role this time around. That might be instructive.
So do you think people take this thing seriously, this negotiation that we have come to see so many times?
Well, when you ask
people,
who are the people you're asking about?
You. I mean, the people in the country who are looking and reading the newspapers.
I think, and I mentioned this before, I think this is a lot like when your small child starts dancing upon a ledge. Mm-hmm. And if they fall and hit their head, it could be catastrophic. The odds that they're going to do that are pretty small, but you do nonetheless ask them to come down.
You better.
And inevitably they say, well, look, I can do this on one foot before they come down. And all the time as a parent, you're thinking, well, the last 1,000 times they did this safely, but there is the chance they gash their head open. I think that's how most of America looks upon this dance.
Wow. I would just think that putting a kid out in a ledge is like a no.
No, they get there themselves.
I understand. I just like, you know, that's bad. But okay, Sarah.
Oh, I'm still trying to learn about all this, even though I was an economics major in college. So I'm learning, you know, this goes back to Alexander Hamilton, which immediately I just start singing lyrics in my head then get distracted. So there's this.
I'll sing along with you.
Oh, thank you. Because you should sing over me, because otherwise people start tuning out. But modern monetary theory, does anybody know about that? But this whole idea that, so the U.S. citizens apparently are the people who have the biggest stake in this matter, and the debt in question is is some of the most like secure debt on the planet and is held in everybody's retirement portfolios. So more people should really care about, I should care about this more than I do. But I think to Mark's point, it's so important. It's such a bedrock of our budgeting process that it's hard to get too excited about it unless you're in Washington, D.C. and can use it for leverage.
So modern monetary theory basically meaning print as much money as you need.
No. What is Mark?
Well, yes, but just to clear things up, modern monetary theory is the theory that deficits don't matter. And I'd like to quote one of the experts that I follow when he talked about refuting that. He started by saying, it's so stupid, I can't believe I have to refute it. Deficits do matter. If you want to find out why, just look to what happened in the United Kingdom this summer. If you don't have a country that looks to the markets like it's on sound financial footings, the markets will punish you and make life very difficult for you. The issue here with the deficit is, I'm sorry, with the deficit ceiling is it has nothing to do with the budgetary process. It's basically as if your credit card has come due and you and your partner now are agreeing to stroke the check to pay off the credit card. You've already spent the money. You just somehow have to agree to take the money out of your joint account. That's the exercise that we're watching happen. And the Republicans have decided, they started back in Newt Gingrich's time, they've decided that when there's a Democratic president in place, they're going to use this threat, this sort of murder-suicide threat, to extract these vague promises on spending reductions. And if you recall, during Trump, they raised this limit three times without any kerfuffle around extracting spending promises.
Linda.
Yeah, I'm ready to come in here. I kind of want to start by quoting Adam Schiff from last week because I like simple English. And debt, deficit, debit, these are not my areas. This is. Adam said last week, he said, and hang on, I just lost it. I just had it called up here. So I could read it, and of course, there it's gone. Okay, here it is. He said, let's not overcomplicate this. Republicans passed a $2 trillion tax cut for billionaires and corporations, and now they're refusing to pay for it. It's just that simple. And it really is just that simple. The fact is, you know, the debt is what we've accumulated over the years, over the country. The deficit is what we spend and what we take in is more of a short-term thing. And the Republicans are absolutely counting on people conflating the two and getting a little confused. I mean, if America defaults on its debt, the whole world fails. But we didn't, under Trump, that didn't happen because, as you said, they made an enormous tax cut there for the wealthy. And you could, right this minute, you could cure 90% of what Kevin McCarthy is whining about if you just rolled back that tax cut.
And, Mark?
Well, Linda, I think you're apt to, I think that's a very insightful observation. And if you read the press, even in the last couple days, it does seem like the Republicans have succeeded in making this a discussion about spending cuts. As opposed to about basically the net of what we tax and then what we spend. And so you're right. I think the Republicans, in a way, already have the upper hand in this negotiation, never mind the fact that, as you say, this doesn't need to be a negotiation at this point over the spending cap, and the Republicans have gotten the upper hand just by making the threats that they've made here.
So this is like a big government, small government thing, essentially, over and over and over and over and over again.
And we know that the Republicans, when they talk about cuts and spending cuts, we know what they're talking about. They are talking about Social Security,
right,
and Medicare, and especially Medicaid, because, by golly, that helps poor people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We will talk more about the story. We'll also zoom in on your letters and read those as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'd love to hear from you. We'll continue after this break in news from the BBC. Good morning. Thank you very much for being with us this morning. We are talking about the discussions going on between the president and the Speaker of the House regarding the debt ceiling. I just went in and checked in on the letters, and they're kind of bitchy. But here we go. I'll read a couple of them. Dear panel, I'm guessing that 90% or more of Americans don't give a large rodent's rectum about the national debt. They're too busy working to make ends meet. That from Mark. Please, no one ask Mark what MMT is. He obviously has no idea.
Oh.
Oof. His explanation of Britain's kerfuffle last year would need too much space to refute, but let me just say he's wrong. That's from John.
Geez.
Would you like to?
I wonder what John's credit card debt is.
Well, that's not fair. My understanding of the proponents of modern monetary theory is the theory that the size of the U.S. deficit is essentially inconsequential. You could run up as much debt as you like because you have forever to pay it. You've got the U.S. economy behind it. The bad news behind that is that although some deficit spending, particularly on projects with a longer payback, is justified, there is ultimately a limit on how much debt any economy, any person can bear. And if you look at the United Kingdom, that's a perfect example of a developed Western economy that when the government put in place a plan that looked incredible in terms of its ability to maintain sound financial footing, the market said, that doesn't do it for us, and you are now far riskier than we thought you were, and we are going to punish you in the financial markets. The United States is a long way from that limit, but there is a limit somewhere that the United States could exceed, and if we did, it would be devastating for our economy.
Pete writes, obviously there's no fat on D.C. spending, no difference on health outcomes for those with or without Medicaid. You people are nowhere near as smart or well-informed as you think you are.
Okay, what about there have been a lot of reports recently, too, about the best way to reduce poverty is to just give people cash and increase the child tax credits. Widen the safety net. It actually catapults people out of poverty. So I've been reading reports by people much smarter than me that tell me all of those things.
So there.
Michael writes, Mr. Whitman conveniently cherry-picks certain aspects of modern monetary theory being true one day and then oversimplifies it the next day in order to dismiss it in principle. Call this a straw man dolly double. All right.
Man.
He's making a grimace on his face.
Yes. Here, let me get to the mean letters. No, I'm just kidding. What about the 14th Amendment? Public debt has to be paid is what most people understand this amendment to say. The Treasury should simply keep paying off the debt of the U.S. created by Congress as required by the Constitution. If the Republicans want to cut the deficit, they should go at it. However, the approved budget must be paid. After all, money is fungible. It is mostly not even done with paper exchange anymore. That from Lloyd. Then we go to this one. The Groundhog's tradition apparently has everyone in a sour mood because these letters are really grumpy.
Yeah.
That's from Shyla telling us that. The budget deficit of the United States of America is nothing more than a picture. A true photo of the budget deficit of the world and all the nations in it. The budget deficit number is a superfluous number, meaning really nothing. All right. That from Santo. We go, but it doesn't mean, I guess it goes back to a question that you were asking earlier of how much does the average person watch and concern themselves with this. Right. Yes.
Quite right.
All right. Let's see. We go to, I'd like to hear Mark's take on why there is never any discussion of cutting government subsidies for big oil companies making record profits when people are struggling to fill their gas tanks. Why is it help for the poor? Why is it help for the poor is bad, but help for wealthy corporations is something we have to live with? That from Jim from Glenmont.
Yeah, Mark, you capitalist, you.
Yeah, those are all great questions. I think that the United States does need to reorient its priorities. I am not in disagreement that at this point in the evolution of our economy, we should not be subsidizing fossil fuel companies to any extent. So if there are taxes that we can justifiably generate by removing subsidies from fossil fuel companies in the United States, I believe that by and large we should.
How come we don't?
Well, because there are very powerful
indeed
lobbying groups led by those same companies.
Right.
That, you know, the interesting thing in our politics is that you think of the economy as and politics as worlds that should be somewhat separated, but they're not. You can garner disproportionate political influence in our political system by spending lots of money to lobby for what you want. And that's why we see this imbalance in terms of tax policy and spending policy. With respect to policies for the poor, actually, on this very show, I have long been a proponent of continuing the child tax credit that was issued during the depths of the pandemic. It was incredibly effective. Now, I will say that there have been some academic reviews of that policy that suggests you do have to put limitations on it to continue to encourage families to be productive members of the economy. But nonetheless, there's still a lot of room to go in terms of increasing that subsidy on behalf of families with children in order to lift them out of poverty. It was incredibly effective when we did it during the depths of the pandemic. We literally cut childhood poverty in this country in half. And then Joe Manchin decided we were spending too much money, and we removed that policy. Now, again, I think over the long run, if you have a policy like that, it does have to be more, the structure has to be more nuanced. But there's still a lot to be gained from examining those handouts. And it is true that, look, our deficits do matter. Modern monetary theory is a lot less sensitive to deficit spending than we all ultimately need to be. There are limits for this country. The good news is that if you spend an extra, you know, trillion here, trillion there in this country, we're an incredibly powerful economic machine, and we don't necessarily feel it right away. But the basic inclination of the Republicans to take a step back and look at the rate of spending in this country isn't necessarily a bad thing, but there's no justification whatsoever in terms of linking it to the raising of the debt cap. That's just, you know, it's frankly hostage politics.
Yeah, I mean, everybody should sit down and periodically review their finances, their debt ratios, their income streams, and this can be a healthy process. The problem is that it's political. So I couldn't agree more. And the idea that, you know, the children can starve so that people with money invested in treasury you know, hedge their risk is really nauseating.
Okay, I want to read. Linda, anything you'd like to add to that?
No, I happen to agree with everything he says, and especially that last sentence. There was a piece in The Atlantic earlier this week where it talks about the fact that America is a huge country full of decent people who are offended by bullying and cruelty. And yet the Republican Party seems overcome by bullying and cruelty in these modern days. And many of us find it offensive on a human decency level. And it's funny that it enters in not to our political discussions, but our monetary discussions. our taking care of children discussions, our education discussions, every single discussion we come to, we come back around to, and let's not forget the policing discussions, we come back to the notion and the word of cruelty. And who are we becoming? And who stands for cruelty in this country and who does not? And that seems to me becoming fairly clear.
Yeah. It's it is becoming clear. And but again, there does seem to be, even in our letters this morning, you know, there just seems to be something that is not we're not in agreement with as to what's the way to spend the money. We have, well, two things. First of all, we have this letter from Francis, who says, I care about paying the debt because I'm going to have to sell bonds to pay my taxes. They are safe, said the large financial institution holding my money in stocks. Economic terrorism is the best way to describe what the Republicans are doing. So there's Francis's side. Mm. Just a friendly reminder to our listeners. I don't think I've ever had to issue this call before, but please do not put the body of your email in your subject line because it's annoying and I can't see it. It doesn't come up on the screen all the way. It just says, what is Mark ... And I don't see it. So if you put it in the body of the email, then when I open it, I can actually see it. So don't do that anymore.
And another thing that I'd like to tell our listeners and suggest to our listeners is that if you want to keep this radio station going, you do everything in your power to do that. And the easy way to do that is go to WAMC.org and put something in the pot.
Indeed, WAMC.org. Okay. That'll put him in a good mood. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We love getting your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Sarcastic, sardonic, sure. Yeah. William writes to us and says, why does the panel ignore what's happening at our southern border, not bringing this issue up? Since 2020, the cartels have astronomically increased their profits in trafficking humans and drugs, making tens of billions in the process. Fentanyl seeps through our porous border, killing over 100,000 Americans each year. The way to stop the cartels is for the U.S. to designate them as terrorists. The cartels have bought off Mexico. Don't you think they're already working on doing the same with the U.S.? Once they succeed, there's no turning back. Have they bought off Joe Biden? What else could explain his refusal to secure our border?
Yeah, what else?
They might have bought off the department.
May I take this one, please?
Yes, please go for it.
May I have a moment?
You may have a moment.
Okay. First of all, I would like to remind the gentleman that there are more people from the United States moving to Mexico every year than there are Mexicans trying to get in the U.S. every year. It's good to keep that in mind, okay? Secondly, the cartels have not bought off the U.S. any more than the American mobsters have bought off the U.S. or the Republican Party has bought off the U.S. We have seen such bad border policy and such mixed border policy, and every time we have a president from a different party, we get even more mixed border policy. This is a big problem. This does need big solutions. And he is right to ask, why don't we discuss that every day? Well, that is because news that is news every day stops being news and becomes fact. And in journalism, like it or not, we report news, not fact. When something happens on the border, we report it. When news is made there, we report it. To say that there has been no reporting about the problems of the United States border is to bury one's head in the sand and say, I guess I just don't read English. Because there has been plenty of reporting, and there is every single day, all over the place. I think what you mean is, why hasn't the reporting satisfied what you want to hear?
That's right.
And why hasn't what been done satisfied what you want done?
That's right.
A separate question.
Yeah.
I'm done.
That was good.
That was very good.
Sarah.
I mean, and if you know the answer, feel free to, you know, pass it along to the White House.
Happy to have it.
Because this is an issue. This is a multi. He raises like at least six different issues in that question, and few of them actually have to do with this current administration and migration patterns. In the 2020 balloon, guess who was president between 2016 and 2020? Anybody?
Yeah.
Remember
that guy?
Who? Yeah. The guy that said, you can't come in. We're going to destroy asylum. We're going to make sure that people from majority Muslim countries cannot enter the United States. We're going to shut down our airports, shut down our borders, stop issuing visas. I'm going to disembowel the Department of State. And I'm going to ramp up the green machine created under the Bush administration, which is the Customs and Border Patrol and Department of Homeland Security. And we're just going to give them a bunch more toys. And last but not least, build that wall. Mm-hmm. Which
and Mexico will pay for it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. None of that happened. That's not true. A lot of that happened, and what happened was that it created this crisis that we're seeing. I've worked with people seeking safety in the Matamoros refugee camps that Joe Biden cleared in his first 6 months, okay? What you're seeing is a ramp up of crime and cartels taking advantage of multiple failures in policy that were exacerbated to a degree that is historically unprecedented by the Trump administration. And that's not just pointing fingers. That's a fact. I'm in the law and fact business and less of the news business, but that's a fact.
So I just want to, this seems as good a time as any to tell folks that Sarah is in a documentary that is going to be, when does it air? It airs
Sunday night at 10 o'clock after the Grammys.
On
MSNBC.
MSNBC.
Well, they're dealing with the Grammys.
For me, it is.
Yeah, you can stream it later.
You can stream it.
It's called Gorilla Habeas, and it is from Trevor Noah's documentary division.
Yeah. Yeah,
and his production company.
Yeah, it's a Turning Point documentary series. It's a series of documentaries that have been airing on MSNBC, and this is one of them. They cover a wide range of topics, and this one is on immigration. And the reason behind the title, Gorilla Habeas, is because I was part of a legal team that worked, and I continued to work with Sarah Gilman, one of the partners in that legal team, on cases up till now, just in a much less dramatic fashion, where habeas corpus is a tool to be able to interrupt rapid deportations under the Trump administration and make sure that the federal government follows its own rules when applying the law to immigrants who, for all intents and purposes, have not broken any laws that would justify their deportation to a country or a place where they would certainly be killed. So pretty dramatic, pretty intense. It's just over 47 minutes running time. So if it's close to your bedtime, Alan, just, you know, drink your tea a little bit later.
No, not me. But it goes by six.
Stream it, find it later. But it's Gorilla Habeas.
It's a great idea.
It tells the story of two intrepid lawyers, Sarah Gilman being one of them.
Right.
And in their crusade against ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and the epidemic of deportations tearing individuals from their families and communities. 10 o'clock Sunday night, MSNBC. And I'll forward this to Sarah, and hopefully she can put a link up so people can find it and find out more information about the work.
I can send Sarah the MSNBC packet.
Oh, the better.
That has everything.
Yes. Yeah. Excellent. A better link. That's fantastic. Thank you very
much. That's the other Sarah.
That's Sarah LeDuc. That's right. Gorilla Habeas is the name of that. All right. We have a few moments before we need to go over and take a break here, but we'll continue our conversation with letters. May I remind a previous letter writer that as much as I believe his presidency was a disaster, President G.W. Bush proposed a reasonable immigration policy that addressed many of our current immigration policies. And who killed his proposal? The Republican Congress. That's who. Is that accurate?
I believe they're referring to a group of Congress members that put together a package. I don't believe it came from the executive, if I'm remembering things correctly. But yes, it's true that the Republicans killed it. They always do.
Let's see. No problem with immigration except, one, the whole thing seems chaotic. No orderly process. That worries me, writes Mark. Two, the U.S. and other nations should really, shouty caps, get after countries whose policies make life so miserable that their people leave.
You know what we should really do is stop agitating the leadership in those countries and destabilizing democracies so that we don't create the conditions that people are fleeing from. That's what we should really do.
You think it would work?
Yeah.
Well, you think, but we're not agitating the leadership of, we've not caused the problem in Venezuela.
No.
Not the proximate cause. I mean, you can go back to the colonialism, but in terms of what's happening with Venezuela today, that's not the United States.
We could cherry pick different countries, but for the vast majority of countries that people are fleeing from, especially in Central America, we have been directly involved in shaping the domestic policies that have created those conditions.
You think that's true with respect to Venezuela?
No.
Okay.
But the vast majority of Central American countries that people are fleeing from, Venezuela is a different
situation. So just to get it straight, when they flee from Venezuela and other countries like it, that's our fault?
In some cases, yes. And in some cases, we have, if it's not our fault, we have a presence in those countries from a intelligence standpoint that could, and we have the ability to increase, speaking of debt, to increase the paltry 3% of the budget that's spent on stabilizing democracies and support to other countries in the world. You know, America First had a ripple effect across the globe, meaning we don't invest in other emerging democracies, and then we end up having to clean up the very human problems that result.
Sarah, may I propose, maybe we can agree on this statement. If the United States spent as much energy and resources currently assisting countries in Central America as we spent historically disrupting them, we would be in a lot better shape.
Agreed.
Okay.
100%.
On that, let's see. We have three letters before we go to break. Gail says, thank you, Sarah, for telling the truth. We go to Lynn, who says, I like Sarah's line, I'm in the law and fact business. We go to Joseph, who writes, I agree. Of course I agree. Well, obviously, I agree with you. Yes, I completely agree. I agree. I do agree. That's my imitation of your show, Joseph.
That's great.
And finally, Jeff, who writes, I don't understand why everyone who knows they're going to contribute to WAMC's every fund drive doesn't get it out of the way as soon as the lockbox chatter commences.
Yay.
I understand that many people contribute as they are able and not necessarily every drive, but if you know you're going to give, why do you wait? So please do it already so we can close this one out as soon as possible.
Well, Joe, if I may.
Words from Jeff.
Yes, they are, and I want to speak to that very quickly. 500,000 people listening to this radio station every month. so that, you know, 5,000 people may contribute. That means there are an awful lot of other people who are out there who use the radio station and who know they use it and who know what they should do. So please, I'm asking you, please, this is Alan speaking, just support the radio station, WAMC.org. That's where you go. You put something in, you feel better, and your whole life turns around.
All right, we'll leave it there. WAMC.org, WAMC.org. We will be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. It is the 2nd of February, Groundhog Day, 9 minutes past 10 o'clock, and we welcome you to the program. Let's move on and go to other stories making news, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. This has a somewhat overlapping component to it. Governor Kathy Hochul of New York, the governor of New York, presented a $227 billion budget plan yesterday, and included is a multi-year plan to help bail out the city's ailing subway system and, this is where we want to get to you, Sarah, and address the migrant crisis that is upon the city. This was the governor's annual budget report. The governor is proposing diverting revenues from three planned casinos in the New York City region to help the authority and called on the city to pitch in nearly $500 million, all of which can add up to $1.3 billion for the subway system, planning to help the MTA, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, cover its budget gap of nearly $3 billion by 2025. The negotiations obviously are bound to expose ideological rifts and power struggles between the governor, a moderate Democrat who is looking to establish her place in Albany after winning her first full term, and more left-leaning Democrats in control of the state legislature who have already successfully challenged her this year. As we mentioned, there is also this matter of the migrants. Where Eric Adams sits into all of this, not only with the migrant situation, but also with the subway plan, and the governor saying the governor's subway plan could further strain our already limited resources. And so that is basically where we are. I am looking for the one part of on the specific proposal regarding migrants, which doesn't come up immediately. But let me,
Joe, while you look for that, could I just make a comment about the subway plan?
You certainly can make a comment about the subway plan.
I think it's laudable that Governor Hochul is looking to assist the city with respect to the capital plans around the New York subway system. Unfortunately, governors and mayors for decades decided and figured it out that if they didn't properly invest in that system, it didn't show up during their tenure. But unfortunately, the ill effects of the disinvestment in that system have now shown up in many ways. And I always claim when I rode the subway more regularly that it would be illegal for us to be packed in like that if we were animals going to the slaughterhouse. So it was unclear to me why that was okay in the subway system. So I think Hochul does get some credit here. And the fact that the New York mayor is being asked to put some skin in the game and that he says that amount of money makes him somewhat uncomfortable is probably the perfect answer in terms of the governor asking the city to join in trying to reinvest in that system.
Because it's usually the city that's asking the state for some extra resources, that's for sure.
Yeah, too often that's the case. But even if you look back to Bloomberg's administration, one of the big things that he did was use money that should have been put into that system for the general fund and make the ledgers look a lot better. And as I said, unfortunately for irresponsible politicians, the effect of not investing in that system doesn't show up tomorrow or the next day or, frankly, even before the next election. But we, if you want to see what the cumulative effect of that is, just go ahead and head down
get
to those tunnels.
Subway.
Yeah, get on the subway.
Alan, your thoughts?
No, I think it's all been said. Our subway system, for those of us who ride it, I still do, I guess Mark still does, is problematic. And so many times when you get on and you see people being pushed around like sardines and pushed into subway cars and in some cases being pushed onto railroad, onto tracks, it's most problematic.
And about the governor's budget overall?
Well, I think she's doing a good job. I think the fact that she's a woman counts for a great deal, to tell you the truth. I know that gender should not matter that much, but it does. And I think the fact that that this particular politician is doing a job which is perceived by so many people as being very good is very good for what we have always known as a divide between men and women in politics.
$1 billion set aside to address the migrant crisis in New York City. Mayor Adams has spoken out very loudly about this over the last several weeks. Sarah, can you briefly talk about that crisis and how we got to this point and what will $1 billion buy us?
I just want to remind everyone that this is a crisis that is manufactured by Republicans. Currently sitting elected high-ranking Republican officials who have decided to take matters into their own hands and send people from the southern border to New York City via bus. That is not an organized way to manage an immigration situation at the border. It is it's a political move by Republicans to put stress on liberal governments, areas that have been perceived of as sanctuaries. And what is perceived of as a more welcoming place in the United States for immigrants than New York City for now, because it hasn't been under the Adams administration, okay? That it's not an open arms situation. It's I won't go too deep into the rabbit hole on that, but this morning I saw that Mayor Adams' ratings are slipping. And I think this is a piece of that, because rather than coordinating services, and this is something that I am working on very actively across the state, creating systems navigators. You know, they don't have to. We need immigration lawyers to help process these folks, get them in the system, and get them the on the path to citizenship. But we also need systems navigators, people who can connect folks to the existing infrastructure in New York State that has plenty of capacity to help resettle folks. So this is a large state investment. Some have spoken out that it doesn't go far enough. Of course, we can always do more as a powerful, wealthy state to share that wealth with these folks who did not choose to come to New York City in some cases. In other cases, they did, but only after an offer from Republicans to take them from where they were. So this would provide social services support for asylum seekers, including shelters, National Guard deployment, healthcare needs, and other things, rather than shuttling migrants to a makeshift shelter in Red Hook or elsewhere in the state and sort of expecting them to just hang out there until the federal government figures out what to do with them. And while Mayor Adams runs around pointing the finger at everybody else but his own administration for this issue.
So look, this has been an area of expertise for you, and I'm sure everybody who's listening to the radio want to know what should be done.
So I think this goes a long way towards what should be done, right? There's also $43 million in the budget to fund the Office for New Americans and existing, it's my understanding, I don't know the details, but I would imagine existing immigration lawyer networks in New York State. There is a bill that I helped put together mm-hmm. 3, 4, 5 years ago now that would mandate representation for anybody who's facing deportation in New York State, because there is no federal system to give representation to immigrants, even though it's the government that is consistently on the opposing side and has the upper hand in deporting people. And that system is so broken that it's even deported United States citizens, by the way. So at the very least, making sure that immigration lawyers can do their jobs in New York State is a good thing. It reduces the burden and then backlogs. It gets people through the system that is established. It is the line that people say, why don't they get in line? Well, this is the line. So then we've got to, like, fund the line. It's like getting in line at Disney World, and then they shut everything down and say the ride's broken. The line's just going to get longer, and people are going to get upset. So it's making sure that the immigration attorneys have support. And then these social support services, right? We can very easily get children enrolled in CHIP benefits, and there are some benefits that immigrants in New York State are eligible for. Many of these folks, not all of them, but many of them have what's called a parole status. So they already have employment authorization. They already have permission to work. So connecting them with jobs, connecting them with affordable housing, connecting them with the services that we have available to support folks. And what we've learned time and time and time and time and time again in New York State is that when we do this, our economy becomes stronger overall. Tom DiNapoli regularly issues a report, the New York State Comptroller, about the contribution of immigrant New Yorkers to the tax base. It's enormous. And this is an opportunity for New York City to continue that tradition. And it's really a big fumble by Adams. He got what he wanted, which is more funding, right? He said, I can't do this. I need the governor to give me more money. So that's fine. The people I work with are organizing, have been organizing for over 2 years on these issues ever since the Afghan evacuation, right? So there are lots of really well-intentioned nonprofit groups that have focused on this issue for a long time. They need resources. And it's really just to plug people into the existing structures. So we will save money, and actually we will reap benefits in not so long-term of a timetable from this investment.
Linda?
Are you kidding? I have nothing to add to that other than to kneel down and go, brava.
Oh, wow.
Are you kidding? That's great.
Let's go. Anybody else?
No, everything you say is so right. And I can't help but think that it also, everything you say reflects what I was saying earlier, that, and this is still my belief, that most people are decent and well-intentioned people. And the case you make for give them the money to do the work is all important. I mean, we have said we are a nation of immigrants with pride. All my life I have heard that said. We are a nation of immigrants, and it was said with pride. Now the Republican Party would have us say that as though it were a declaration of war. And I find it morally offensive in every way. And thank you for saying what you did.
Let me go to some other letters here from listeners to bring us up to the bottom of the hour. This from Charles, who says 800,000 people come here legally each year, mostly brown and black people, even during Trump. Is 800,000 enough?
Did you say legally or illegally?
I wanted to know that too.
It said legally.
Legally, okay.
Oh, no. I mean, the business sector is clamoring for more migration.
Bodies. Yeah.
The labor pool is so shallow, and this is such a dependable source And I hate talking about people this way because I hate reducing people to what they can contribute to the labor market. But I'm dealing in facts here. And the fact is the business community is begging for a solution that would allow them to employ these folks. And really, if with the federal government making the decision, the one thing that the Biden administration has done recently that I think makes some sense is to give these folks a status called parole, which is a limited duration period of time where they have employment authorization and don't have to apply separately for it, which can sometimes get backlogged and take 6 months, which is ridiculous because what do you do for 6 months while you can't work? So folks are getting employment authorization and they can be plugged right into that labor market that's crying out for their services. And then they can get, you know, they can resettle themselves. This isn't like, I get really tired of the idea that it's the poor huddled masses. Like that's not modern migration theory. Okay. If we're going to talk about modern monetary theory, modern migration theory is human capital. We're dealing with humans, not Bitcoin, not imaginary pieces of paper that we don't use anymore. These are human beings who can better help us build community, who do help us build community, have historically helped us, who was us, right? Like colonial settlers, I guess, but like the communities, the fabric of communities in this country.
Mark?
I will say, if you look at countries, and China's a great example, there were fears a few years ago that China's economy would eclipse ours in size. And now the consensus is that's no longer likely. And one of the main reasons is because they don't have any immigration system. So as their population continues to age, the economic prospects of their country dim quite a bit. We don't face that because we are a unique country in terms of historically how accepting we have been of immigrants. And as Sarah says, I don't mean to reduce the contributions of any people in this country to purely their economic contributions. Obviously, there are far more than that. In a different political environment, the Democratic mayors facing these problems would band together with the Republican governors at the border state and force some sort of change within Congress, because it is only Congress that really has the power to effectively rewrite our immigration system. The courts are now de facto making policy, and Sarah could speak to this better than I, but there's actually even legal doctrines within immigration that talk about when there are conflicting laws, when the one law says you have to do this, but there isn't enough money to do it, how you work that out. Well, Congress can work that out in an instant by properly addressing this problem. Unfortunately, Alan, to sum up, I think this immigration problem falls under the rubric of it has to start to smolder before Americans finally decide that both parties are going to get together and do something. And that's unfortunate. But let's hope we
do. You think that'll happen?
I think at some point there has to be a compromise on immigration for the system to work. And I think if it doesn't, the ill effects of the current system will become so severe that they will at some point force a compromise. The only issue is how bad does it get?
Mm-hmm.
We'll know a lot.
How do you factor in or solve the racism that is mixed in with the immigration issue?
So that is a part of the documentary as well. Definitely tune in Sunday night because I speak to that issue, that some of the first immigration laws in our country that ever existed, which, by the way, was in the early 20th century. So most, if you're white and European of European ancestry, most of these laws did not apply to your generations who migrated here and settled in the United States. The Chinese Exclusion Act was one of them. Those three words, Chinese Exclusion Act, it was an overtly racist law.
Absolutely.
And that's the foundation. That's the bedrock. And that is where we started in immigration law and policy in the United States. We went from...
So I would think where we started was before that, when we began to bring Africans and enslave them as people and call it immigration.
Excellent point.
All right. Let's get to just another letter or two, and then we will move on and take a break here. So we go to Doreen. The system that is needed for immigrants is the same system that's needed for the homeless: housing, jobs, health care. Yet the government has not been able to solve the problem of the unhoused. It feels like a losing battle.
You know, I love that point, and I also have a critique of that point. I love that point because what I've been saying and advocating is that these systems that my students are inventing and proposing lift all boats, right? Rising tide, a rising social support network that's more interconnected, that works from an app-based platform that's been in development for years and years and years and was originally designed to assist with individuals who were formerly incarcerated reentering society, right? The critique I have is that I want to make sure that we're decoupling migrants from the home, from the unhoused, and also from formerly incarcerated, because the needs are different and the emphasis on which social supports are most central to their success are different. And also just want to make sure that we're paying attention to how this fits into our earlier conversation about budgets and budgeting instruments as moral documents, right? And where we put the emphasis in society and how we can really change all of this by changing the direction of the budget process in the federal government.
How likely is that?
Depends on how people vote and when they vote. And they got to vote all the time.
So you think even the people who are voting Democratic will have that choice in mind?
1 minute warning. Go ahead.
I do. And I think that all Democrats should listen to progressives on these issues because they are raising the surgically important points in terms of what to think about when you're looking at candidates in the Democratic Party.
All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue and have the last segment of the show. Alan Chartok, Mark Whitman, Sarah Rogerson, and Linda Ellerbe this morning. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Mark Whitman, Sarah Rogerson, and Linda Ellerbe. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. Last call on those. We have about 15 minutes left to discuss and also remind you about the lockbox and the fact that it is open and we need you. We're more than halfway, about $540,000 in the lockbox so far, but still a long way to go and we need your help.
It can't be done without you. You know, for those people who are listening to WAMC every day, and I know how many of you there are, you know, this is a time when we really need you. We don't want to huck you. We don't want to tell you that, you have to do this or that. It's just a matter of personal responsibility, and we hope you'll take it because we really do need you. It's that simple, WAMC.org. Let me give you that again, WAMC.org.
All right, you heard him, WAMC.org. Let's see, couple of things in the mailbox I'd like to get to. Steven said, can you please repeat the title, date, and time of the special? It is called Gorilla Habeas. It is a documentary that will feature Sarah Rogerson, and it will air 10 p.m. on Sunday on MSNBC.
That's right.
And we do have a link up. Or will very soon. And you can find out all the information there. But it's called Gorilla Habeas on MSNBC. All right. We now go to a pet peeve letter from James. These are always fun. Thanks, Joe. I have three pet peeves. One is people who use the term pet peeves. Two is people who park at a gas tank and go shopping. And three is people who put the body of their message in the title of their email. And then we go to David. Cool. I never thought the roundtable could get any better. And then Linda Ellerbe shows up.
Yep.
Her TV show, Our World, was my favorite program ever. I'm doubling my donation to the station. Thank
Whoa.
You very much from David Brown. I loved Our World. What was that, 86?
That was 86 and 87, yes.
You and Ray Gandolf.
He was wonderful. The late Ray Gandolf.
The late Ray Gandolf.
Unfortunately, yes.
Arun Arledge production.
Wonderful to work with writers, you know? It's there is an old belief that many people share about television, which is that we know more than we tell. I have always thought the opposite to be true. But then after that, I have had occasion to work with some very good television writers, Lloyd Dobbins, Gandolf, Bill Schechner. These were people that it was an honor to work with because they appreciated the word and they understood the word and they wrote all their own words. If you work in the business, it's very easy to tell when you're watching television pretty much whether or not that reporter wrote what they're saying or is reading what someone else wrote. If I were queen of the world, I would make all journalists write what comes out of their mouth. That might give us better clues. But that doesn't happen. Nevertheless, thank you for that very kind letter. I think it probably offsets the one I recall that said they'd give double if I'd shut up. So this is a good direction.
Yeah. Just for anyone who hasn't seen the show, Our World was that you took a moment, like a week in history, right? And then you would go back, and then that episode would be on that and that time in history.
It was a different way of looking at history in that we would slice through the tree. Most of the times we teach history in disciplines. Here's the history of art. Here's the history of politics. Here's the history of film. Here's the history of this. Our world would take a period of time, never a year, because we'd run out of subjects.
No.
3 weeks, a day, a week of a particular year, and slice through the tree and say, here's what happened in the news. Here's who we were. Here's what we were reading. Here's what we were watching at the movies. Here's what we were singing. Here's what the people are in those famous photos from that time. Here's what they were thinking. Here's what the person next to them was thinking, which was often more interesting.
I have to say it was just such a great show, but they put it up. Linda had left NBC. Did you leave or you were fired? You were fired, right? You were fired from NBC.
I was not fired. Technically, I would say fired. They offered me a 40% pay cut. To me, that's a lot like being fired.
Yes, I would say so.
I could have said, yeah, sure, I'll be happy to work for 40% of the pay. But as I had an offer from ABC and CBS, I just saw no reason to say that.
So then they put the show, then ABC puts the show up against The Cosby Show, which is, you know, the mega hit.
At that time, it had 30 million viewers a week.
Oof. Yeah. Well, that wouldn't be the case now.
Any network that could get 30 million viewers a week for a sitcom these days would own television.
I apologize for geeking out here just in a minute because I think by now everyone knows my love for Linda. But am I right on this? I vividly remember this, Linda. But didn't you go on the Tonight Show to plug the show with Bill Cosby as the host?
Yes. It seems like a good time.
I don't understand. I mean, could
what
you
was
explain
he
going to
say?
Bill Cosby
I
was...
I hope your show is canceled. Hell, we were already on the way to being canceled. You didn't have to say it.
Bill Cosby was filling in for Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show.
Right.
Bill Cosby was the reason why Linda's show wasn't a number one hit because it was the number one hit. And as she said, 30 million people were watching it. But she went on as a guest on The Tonight Show with Bill Cosby as the host. And
I asked him if he would consider a short leave of absence or a long one.
September 23rd, 1986. You can pull it up.
Oh, is it there? Mm-hmm. Oh, that's cool. Oh, yeah. That's really great. Watch it. It's very, very cool. Okay, let's go on to other stuff. Although I could just do this. Okay. I want to talk about the AP, and I'm not talking about the Associated Press. I am advanced talking placement. About advanced placement. Yeah. That is correct. Much in the news, especially going to the state of Florida and what the governor there has done. However, we look at what is happening here and think that this is a what we're seeing is some of the changes that have taken place. And as soon as I bring this up,
Joe,
but go ahead.
I'll give you a brief summary, and then you can, like all the letter writers do on economic topics, you can fix me up afterward. The Florida board that approves the educational curriculum for high school said that it was against the law to teach the AP course, which is, by the way, a elective course that is going to be offered on African American history. And they cited a lot of the discussion around queer theory and some of the
critical race theory.
Thank you, as well as Black Lives Matter.
So now the College Board
has come back and modified that course and taken out some of the more controversial and recent issues inside of that course.
Like
and now so those some of those things like Black Lives Matter mm-hmm. are optional.
Right, and I think some of the writings from Bell Hooks have been taken out.
And a bunch of other authors.
Right, and I have a view on this. First of all, I think Ron DeSantis is clearly playing the culture war card, sure. Getting his presidential candidacy ready. He doesn't want to jump in against Donald Trump because Donald Trump has proved a very effective opponent against himself thus far. But eventually we all expect DeSantis to enter, and it's too bad that he's using race to prove his bona fides as a culture warrior conservative.
Racist.
Right. But I will say on behalf of the AP, I do like the fact that they were willing to modify this course. If you can get some of the package, even if you can't get all of it, and if this makes it more palatable to more institutions and it still is accepted again, it's an elective, then I think we should actually applaud when we see people take reasonable measures to meet in the middle on topics that don't need to be so darn controversial. The good news is if a student in that course wants to go read Bell Hooks, they can go to the library, or when they get to college, they can pick it up. So I think it's an interesting argument. It's a little bit complex. I think it's unfortunate that DeSantis and the Florida Board of Education took the extreme position they did. But faced with that decision, I think it's great that the AP board did what they could to try and come to some sort of compromise. And let's be realistic about what Black Studies does. I mean, when it was originally designed in America, part of it was to encourage, you know, Black Americans themselves to realize that they had a greater stake in America, and even amidst a time of intense turmoil. But we're all smarter than that now when we realize that this history is important and essential to all of us, and it is a more realistic picture of our future. So I applaud the AP for kind of getting what they can, and I think we should be careful about criticizing people when they come to reasonable compromises, even when it's with an unreasonable party.
There are just three points I'd like to make from the New York Times coverage of this. The study of contemporary topics, including Black Lives Matter, incarceration, queer life, and the debate over reparations, are downgraded in the test. The subjects are no longer part of the exam, but are simply offered on a list of options for a required research project. And even that list is, in a nod to local laws, can be refined by local states and districts. The expunged writers and scholars include Kimberly Crenshaw, a law professor at Columbia, Roderick Ferguson, a Yale professor who has written about queer social movements, Ta-Nehisi Coates, the author who has made the case for reparations for slavery, and the aforementioned Bell Hooks. David Blight, who is a professor of American history at Yale University, said Wednesday that he had written an endorsement of the new curriculum at the board's request, and that he believed it had much to offer, not just about the history, but also about Black poetry, art, and the origins of the blues, jazz, and hip-hop. But he withdrew his endorsement on Wednesday after learning that some of those sections had been cut.
Yeah, I hear you, Mark. I think there's something.
Let's go to the school board member now.
There's something very troubling about an
unendorsement of historically marginalized groups. The whole point of making sure that a curriculum includes certain subjects is making sure that people are exposed to that those subjects, because otherwise we run the risk of rubber stamping an incomplete education because people are bigoted. And that is not what our education system is set up to do. It's set up to challenge folks and expose them to more ideas. It's not like I can say, you know, I want my kids to opt out of white supremacy. I don't get that luxury. There's no governmental instrument that I can push on and say, I don't want my kids to have to deal, you know, to, well, I want them to learn about white supremacy so that they can recognize their own privilege and dismantle it from wherever their vantage point becomes when they're older. But, you know, like that's a very different choice than what the government's going to, a government funded education is going to endorse or hide. It feels like a further marginalization, particular, you know, of groups that don't need that, that really we would all benefit from quite the opposite.
Linda, would you like the final word on this?
I don't know that I'll have the final word. We're not even close to a final word on this, but I agree with that notion that you can't opt out of white history. Why are we able to opt out of black history? Now, I realize this is an AP course, it's a specific thing, and while I kind of want to applaud the, quote, compromise, going down this road of compromising, just a few days ago, not teaching feminism, black feminism, was part of the list of what they didn't want on there, and I tried to think, well, no, wait a minute. We are, last I counted, 51% of the population. So let's not teach history about the black part of our 51%. What is that about? Now, history is history, period. You don't get to pick and choose what you don't like of it. It is what it is. And, yeah, different people write different histories. But we have... Let me just leave with this one thing, is that I was not taught black history. I had to learn it on my own, and I'm still learning it. There are not black children walking around who can say I was not taught white history. There are plenty of white children walking around saying I don't know anything about black history.
Yep.
Or how it affects me, or how I affected it.
Linda,
it's
you're
time
the...
to get over this nonsense. It really is.
You're the best, Linda. Thank you so much for being with us. As always, I appreciate it. Thank you for getting... We get up a little early, right? Do you have to get up a little early to be with us?
I get up a little earlier because I'm on Central Time here.
All right. Well, thank you for doing that. I appreciate
Mexico
it.
Mexico makes it simple. The entire country is on one time zone.
Linda Ellerby, many thanks. Thanks also to Mark Whitman, Sarah Rogerson. Alan, remind them about the lockbox.
Everybody, this is your radio station. You're listening right now. You know what you get from it. And if you are where I think you are, then WAMC.org is the place to go and put something in the box.
We will be right back right after this.